You're set. Now, just a question, all right, we can begin. Today is Monday, April 23rd, 2018. I want to say good morning to the students in front of me, to all those listening across the wide expanse of the Torah world. Yesterday it was a unique moment. I was involved in the tshuva of Rav Alfadja and dealing with can we depend upon non-Jews, government documents, and we got an I told about the OU that they never had a problem with Goyim. It was only with Jews. Twice there was a problem with the people they were giving the Hechsher to, and once there was a problem with a Rav who worked for the OU. And I mentioned he was siphoning off money and they discovered, etc. So I imagine while people were listening, or will listen, they probably listen with one ear. How does Rekefet know this? It doesn't sound possible. It happened a long time ago. And sitting in the class was the man who discovered the theft from the OU. It's the controller sitting right here. That's unbelievable. So I come out of it a king, telling a story, knowing a story. You know how I know it. It's through Meni Holzer, who was the Tsar of Kashra. If you recall, he was the representative of the RCA. We'll come to the delay today or next week. I also want to mention that I was correct. It is official. Rabbi Usher Weiss is the second posek for the OU. And he, together with Rav Heschel Schechter, and that explains why with the Shaila I mentioned after class when we were giving out the freebies, Reb Heschel turned to Rav Usher Weiss with the Shaila.
He's going to live here,
no? He's not going to move. No, today with the computer age, you have to move to America. But Rav Usher Weiss goes back and forth. He has a lot of support in America. He has a kollel here. Yeah. And gives shiurim in America. Yes?
He doesn't go into the factories to check. They bring to him...
Right, right. No, he and Reb Heschel deal with the questions that no one else can deal with. It's only... It's like the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Daf Peichet. Why am I... This is working, not working? See if it's... It's what? It's...
It is on.
Never a dull moment. It's, I have to be sure that this is on. 1 second. Yeah. Okay. It's maybe something loose there. Anything is possible. All right. So Rav Usher Weiss, it is correct, and that explains exactly why Rav Heschel turned to him. What happened was the Shaila of Chometz Shomer Alav Pesach, not the wine Shaila, but it seems they don't give the city. But according to my friend Shmuel Dershowitz, Dr. Dershowitz, Sam Dershowitz, so according to Sam, he believes it happened in Teaneck. Reb Usher Weiss spoke about it. He said that it's in a very major Jewish enclave, and it was some sort of factory where, I don't know if they're selling cookies or something, and over Pesach they were taking the cookies or whatever the product was and putting it into, in other words, they got it in big boxes from the manufacturer and they were repackaging it in smaller packaging. And the OU, who was giving the hashgacha, it was interesting, they claim we listened to what we promised. You know, I read yesterday what the contract read, but it didn't say you can't repackage. And they felt there was nothing wrong. They didn't realize it may be non-Jews. They didn't realize there's nothing wrong with repackaging. So the Shaila is, and comes to the love of Pesach, and Reb Usher Weiss paskin la'locha that it's okay. That, you know, how much of love Pesach, only it didn't the Rabbanan, and here, what did they do? They didn't use it. They didn't do business with it. It's not Jews involved. So he paskin la'locha that b'di'evet, it's okay. Again, I don't know all the details. The Shaila is doesn't give details. It's just fascinating that the Shaila is answered to Rav Heschel Shechter, Hagon, Rav Heschel Shechter, Rosh Yeshivat, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchok Chanan. So, ani mekavev that I understand it correctly. Okay, let's come back here to Matzat. The question that we raised with Matzat, and I'm only raising it in relation, I want to put Manashevitz on the map, but it's fascinating that the people reacted from all over the world. Halacha l'maisa, there's no doubt that what I said last week is correct, that the real halachic shailas are how good is the machinery? Do pieces fall off? That's one shaila. The lishmar is another shaila. Beyond those two basic shailot, really, all you get involved with are meta halachic considerations, or secondary halachic, or more, I would say, tradition more than halacha. And if you recall, I discussed this a few years ago, but I see that people wrote in, so let me say I'm well aware of it. That number one, the issue was raised that this is a social injustice. And this takes us into a whole different era, beginning with the Industrial Revolution. The human being becomes secondary in importance. The human being loses his job. This takes us back to Reb Aaron Cutler. The stories that reverberate in many different variations, but the basic story is very simple, that Reb Aaron lived in Brooklyn. He had to get to Lakewood. A Talmud would drive him every week, and when they would go on the New Jersey Turnpike, you'd have a choice to pay the toll either with coins or someone would take the money and give you change. And Reb Aaron was always makpid to go where the person takes the money. And they asked Reb Aaron, why are you makpid on that? And the Rosh Yeshiva answered, how would you feel if, as a human being, you saw a machine taking your place? I need not tell you that nowadays this problem has intensified 1,000 times over. How many of us go to a bank today? You rarely have to go to a bank. Everything can be done long distance. My children can show me they can deposit checks simply with their camera. They photograph the check. They send it on. I mean, to my mind, it's beyond comprehension. But and I ask my children, what do you do with the checks? They say, oh, the bank tells us to hold it for a few more days. And once we see it went in, we can rip it up and throw it away. Could you imagine? But that's the world today. So the case was made that who worked in the hand factories, these were Yatomim, these were Almanot, these were people that waited all year to find Panasa for Pesach, and here we're taking their Panasa away. All right, this is a problem that haunts us in general in life. The truth of the matter is that as the world moves on, yes, you lose certain jobs and more jobs are created. Who could believe what goes on today? Ah, Zev, welcome. Who can believe what goes on today that you have a lady, one of the ladies who lit one of the torches, if I'm not mistaken, the torch, I don't think she got Pras Yisrael, but this is a Haredit lady. And why did she light the torch? Because she has gone into high tech, created jobs for hundreds if not thousands of Haradiyot women. So you see, could you imagine 100 years ago where these women were told when Pesach comes, you'll roll out matzah, you'll work in a bakery, a matzah bakery, and here these women are working in high tech. So the world moves on. Jobs close, jobs open. So this has also been mentioned in the response to literature, why we're opposed. Yes, Morty.
But there's two sides to the coin. On the other hand, you had someone had large families and they want shmor matzah. So the machine matzah is, 15-20% the price of hand
matzah. Not to say that
someone who can't afford can afford that.
Not to say that you're bringing in that economic consideration, but if someone is opposed to machine matzah, they're going to spend more, and a lulav and an etrog, and he spends on an etrog, he wants a mehudashep, a mehudarim, but all right, the parnasa for the poor people becomes a factor, a small factor, but a factor. The other matter, which I mentioned years ago, and it's a little bit difficult to quote it in public, is the Divrei Chaim, where the famous Reb Chaim Sansever, and he was held in awe. This was Galitzi, a Hungarian, Posek Mufak, I don't have to tell you his descendants, the Kloisenberger sons of Earth today, the Satmar, all their blood intermingles. So Reb Chaim Halberstam was by far the most famous of the dynasty. He, in Divrei Chaim, the famous Tshuva, where he writes, Hatam Kamus Imadi, and he refuses to reveal the reason. He says, I am opposed. All right, a lot has been written trying to uncover the reason that Reb Chaim Halberstam gave. If I can put it into simple language, when we do Aveirot, we have to do something good to overcome the Aveirot, to make up for the Aveirot. No, tell me, what sounds better? Walking into Osherad, walking into Bingo, and buying 10 kilo of Shmura Matzah? You wait online, you put down a few hundred shekel, face $50, and you walk out. Or working and sweating and being at the oven and it's hot and your fingers are black from soot and then you Baruch Hashem, Hatam Kamusi Madi, I worked very hard, I made up for my Aveirot. And according to the Sharim Mitzvim B'Halachan, the first edition, not the second edition. The second edition, he evidently left it out on purpose. So they say, and I apologize for quoting it, it's not sneistic, but what can I do? Torah hi v'lumoda nitzarich. They say Reb Chaim Halberstam is referring to the sin of shikhvat sera levatala. So the sweat and the harabanya that is exhibited in the baking of matzah is a kapara for the sin. All right, you'll have to admit that these other reasons are secondary, but the halachic question, okay, we discussed it last week, was a tremendous machloikis. What's amazing is the Manashevitz family was able to create a monarchy, a domain, to a certain degree a monopoly of baking matzah, baking square matzahs, which in itself was an innovation, and no one said boo. And here you come to a very interesting research, very interesting story, and that's what I referred to last week. Yes, tremendous machloket, but this machloket did not reach the United States. Why? Okay. In America, you see, in Europe, how did people view the country? They viewed the country, every 10,000 Jews had some hand matzah bakeries. There was no concept of a million Jews getting together. United States, you build up by the 1880s, you have a million Jews. By the 1890s, 2 million. By 1900, 3 million. By World War I, you have perhaps 4.5 million Jews. Look at the statistics. And it's brought down the halacha. In all the sources, you will see it. Look in the Shonim Mitzvim B'Halacha. They recognized that ultimately, if they don't use machine matzahs, there will not be enough matzahs for the people. Plain and simple. And Manashevitz filled this tremendous need. At least the Jews in Europe knew that matzah was available. Manashevitz was doing its job. There's another factor here that affects the situation. Where was the opposition from? The opposition was mainly from the Galician poskim. It was an area that was Hasidic. Hasidic Jews are inbred with the concept of tradition. You have it right now in Gilo. Very fascinating. We spoke about it last year. The Pashkener Rebbe died last year. His son succeeded him. It's the first time in history that we have a Hasidic Rebbe who is a brigadier general in the Israeli Defense Forces. All right? Son succeeded him. Brigadier general. Look at the crowd around him. Yom Ha'atzmaut, a major crowd. 99% of the people around him are wearing kippot sfugot. The Rebbe, and this is a Rebbe with a kippot sfugot on his head. What is he wearing? A Rosh Hashanah. Not a Vishnu Shtreimel, not a Belz Shtreimel. You know the difference. The Rosh Hashanah is smaller, goes up, it peaks up. It's very different. Take a look, go on the internet and knock in Shtreimel and come up with some articles on the difference between Shtreimels. Why? Here's a Rebbe, Tata Luf B'Tzfah and Ali Yisrael, born, raised, total Israeli, total. Whatever beauty you see in the religious Zionist element, this man has it. But yet, to be a Rebbe, there's a tradition. You have to play the role. You have to wear the garment. Hasidim can be opposed to machine matzah because Hasidim want tradition. We wear a bekeshu. We wear a shtreimel. Hasidim, these are neo-Hasidim. They're not going to leave their kippah sfugah. But the Rebbe wears the uniform. These are neo. Take the real Hasidim. Yeah, Vishnitz, Belz in Israel, Satmar in America, Sons Kloisenberg, Israel, America, Square, name whatever Hasidus you want. Lubavitch. All right, they don't wear a shtreimel. That we lectured on that a few years ago. That's our entire story. Why the Lubavitchers don't wear shtreimels? It's not a simple matter. It's not a simple matter. How can that be? You broke the Chassidim in Europe all wear shtreimels. But all right, they don't wear a shtreimel, but they wear a different type of shtreimel. The hat that the Rebbe wore when he became Rebbe in 50, 51. Every chassid, to be a chassid, that's his goal, to have a black hat with the kvetch exactly the way the Rebbe wears it. You follow? So that too, ultimately, becomes tradition. In the United States of America, Charlie, how many chassidim were there in the 1880s, the 1890s, the 1900s, the 1910s? It was Batul b'shishim. It wasn't even a miyutan nikar. The first Hasidic Rebbe that had some success in America, I mentioned it was the Biana Rebbe. That's in the mid-20s already. But until the Biana, yeah, there were two, three Hasidic Rebbeim who came, couldn't succeed, didn't catch on. Well, the Hasidim are not there to yell. You can have Mishin Matzah. You can have Square Matzah. More than that, Manashevitz were geniuses in public appeal, in public relations. They saw that the machine matzah, it's much easier to do square. Think for yourself. By the way, one Talmud wrote to me, Nachum Lam writes to me, that one of the problems originally with the machine matzah was they would cut off, make it round, and what they would cut off would fall away, and that would be chametz. And sometimes they would rebake it, which could be good if it was within 18 minutes, but it was not a simple process. Manashevitz realized, if we're going to worry about round matzah, we're never going to get off the floor. So when they advertised, I still remember this with my own eyes, they advertised Manashevitz square matzah as if it's Tiffany's, you follow? As if it's Lord and Taylor. It's infinitely better. Square matzah. It's more chashuv. It's different. Wow. If this is the case, then you can understand in America, it's a little bit different. Big machloket in Europe, but thank God we have matzah in the United States. Follow? That's part of it. I have to go further. I turned these on, just check that they're working, because I'm not a gon in turning on, but I think I have it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Baruch Hashem. Very fascinating. But now let me go further. Manashevitz understood something else. Good hashgacha. Good rabbanim. Put yourself in a position that you show no one questions your product. The Manashevitz family, which was Hungarian in origins, established very close relationships with the Yerushalayim from Jews. As a matter of fact, the two of the sons of Reber married women from Yerushalayim families. And even Reb Hirsch, who I told you about, Sarah, his wife was born in Cincinnati, but her family was from the old Yishuv of Yerushalayim. Established good relations. They constantly advertised in Hapardes, the rabbinic journal. They constantly opened up their plant. Any Rav visiting America, come. See Manashevitz, see the plant. When they celebrate, I believe it was their 50th anniversary of business, they issued a booklet listing out like 120 plus Rabbanim who visited the plant. Among them, Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook. Among them, Reb Meir Shapiro, the founder of the Daf Yomi. And they visit the plant, and it's very, very impressive. This was a major plant producing hundreds of thousands of matzah a day. One of the sons of Reber had something like 50-plus patents on matzah production, including an electric eye. Again, I'm not Charlie. You have to analyze it and do the research on it. You have the PhD in physics. I'm an amoritz in that field. But an electric eye that could count 600 matzot a minute and divide them up into packages. I mean, this was they unbelievable what Manashevitz.
What year was that?
The 1910s. He died early. Yeah. Let me see if I have a year here. 1 second. But it's amazing. This son, he died young. He was the one who came up with over 15 patents. I'll tell you something fascinating here. Let me see. He died in 1914. So 600 a minute, as well as innovations in packaging and a special matzah machine introduced in 1920, which could produce 1.25 million matzot every day. Okay? And this machine was described in 1938 as the largest, the most expensive single piece of machinery in any bakery in the world. And these people had a knack, and the Rabbanim came, the Rabbanim saw. His name was Jacob. The one who had all the patents was Jacob Uriah Manashevitz. And they had Manashevitz square matzah. But it goes further. And here you come to the research of Jonathan Sonnet. This is the article I referred you to a week ago. It's based upon a lecture he gave at the Graduate School of Jewish Studies at Touro College, the 6th annual lecture of the Victor J. Zalmanowitz Chair of Jewish History at Touro College. Sonnet, S-A-R-N-A. Well-known individual. A wonderful individualism.
Father was a big Bible scholar.
Father taught at the seminary, And as a Zeya, I met him a number of times, very impressed with this Elichkeit, a real, he was ill and he recovered, and he thanks the Ribbono Shel Olam, anything, any book he publishes, he's seen the introduction, and he's a good scholar. He's a historian and somewhat of a sociologist, I would say.
He wrote a book, American Judaism.
It's the radio a few years ago, must be a good 10 years ago, 15 years ago, wrote a very nice volume on American Judaism, what it's like today. But this is constantly, Chaim Waxman just came out with a new sefer, a new book on Orthodoxy in America. I started it last night. I was given a gift by a Talmud, two nice books. One is not that difficult to read, but this one I have to concentrate. But okay, Besaid, we'll see what we can get out of it. But there's more to the story. As we mentioned, Manischewitz began a very close relationship with the Jerusalem community. One of his sons, Rebbeir, the founder's sons who took over the business, the son who lived the longest was Reb Hirsch Manischewitz. Reb Zvi Hirsch Manischewitz, in his youth, the father sent his two elder sons to study in Jerusalem. So they had a connection with the Yerushalayim community. Reb Zvi Hirsch established a little yeshiva in Jerusalem. He supported it. Every year they made a donation. Do you know what the yeshiva was called? The Manischewitz Yeshiva. And
does it still exist?
No, I doubt it.
Where was it?
Again, you asked for an address. I would imagine it was in the old city. Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be anywhere else. And it was the money. They don't give an address here, but this Manischewitz Yeshiva, Reb Zvi Pesach Frank would come in occasionally. Reb Yaakov Moshe Chalap would come in occasionally. When the 50th anniversary, they published the book with all the rabbis, there's a whole description of the yeshiva. Now, could you imagine the impact this has on the greater Torah world? Harpades occasionally writing up news. Where did you get your news then? Rabbinic news, the rabbinic world. You recall the Harpades rabbinic journals. They always had something on Olam HaRabbanut. Occasionally you'd have a piece on the Manischewitz yeshiva. What this accomplished was that the kashrut of Manischewitz matzah was never questioned. It was accepted throughout the world. And the whole machloket in the old country about machine matzah never ever reached the United States. The attitude was, Baruch Hashem, matzah is available in the United States. Baruch Hashem, 3 million Jews can have ample matzah. Baruch Hashem, World War I, the army could provide soldiers with Manischewitz matzah. I need not tell you, World War II is Kal Vachomer, but many more Jews then. But they were geniuses in public relations. Now, how do we know all this? How do we know all this? So Jonathan Sonner, Aryeh, raises the very question, how do I know all this? He said, well, where do we know Manischewitz and the yeshiva and why they support the yeshiva and the interconnection? How do we know this? He says, 1948, there was a court case. The Internal Revenue took Manischewitz to court. Why? Why did they take Manischewitz to court? Because Manischewitz was listing as their expenses all the money that went into the Manischewitz yeshiva in Yerushalayim. Now, they couldn't list it as a charitable donation because the yeshiva did not have the charity status. And they wrote it off, the business expense, just like they wrote off the cartons, the advertising, whatever goes into business, the secretary, the telephones, whatever goes into business, the upkeep of the machinery, they wrote off the yeshiva as part of the expenses of the company. The IRS got wind of it. And by the way, the IRS, those of you who have a little experience, they are very tough. When they pick an issue, boy, oh boy, do they pick an issue. Yitzhak, yeah?
If they would have given the money through the PEF.
I don't know if there was a PEF in 1910.
In 1930.
But you're jumping ahead. This went on for years and years already.
I understand.
They should have approached your father-in-law, Rabbi Goodman.
Brandeis is the one who founded it.
All right, thank you. But it didn't happen that way.
And Mordechai Kaplan's son-in-law, a man called Musher, was the president.
What was his name?
Musher,
M-U-S-H-E-R. Uh-huh. All right. By the way, for Mordechai Kaplan, there are from Jews Alive family. I knew his nephew. I believe he's not alive, but he was president of Riskin Shul in Manhattan at one point. And I knew him here in Yerushalayim, and I had to be very careful not to maledict Mordechai Kaplan in his presence. Well, I should have hurt his feelings. He davened in Old Rivka. He had an apartment, and I used to meet him in Old Rivka.
You had a student in the class who you were very nervous about hurting his feelings because his father made trouble for the Rav in Boston.
Oh, no, Masada. That was his grandfather.
Grandfather.
That's why I never mentioned his grandfather's name, and I was criticized when I write. Why don't I mention the name? So when I responded to the criticism, I recorded a whole, because there was a big article came out on my scholarship. Professor in Bar-Ilan, it's amazing, professor come out with concepts. He tried to show that Aaron Rakefet became more Haredi over the years. I couldn't believe my eyes. The truth is I became less Haredi. I came in Aliyah, I had a black kippah. Today I only wear a kippah, Shrika.
What year in Boston?
What year
was this?
Boston, this the whole thing with the Kashrut investigation, the early 40s.
It started earlier, but
we know, but the accusations against the Reb were the very early 40s. And they had to order a state investigation. They appointed a retired judge, A.K. Cohn. Bushnell was the attorney general of the state of Massachusetts. And that rabbi who claimed the Rav was making money under the table and monopolistic and not reporting taxes, so many years later, the IRS got after him, and the Rav used his influence to spare him from going to jail. Okay, it shows the character of the Rav. But nevertheless, his grandson was a dear Talmud of mine. More than that, here. That's his grandson standing with me in front of Yeshivat Mir. After he got smicha from YU, he went back to Mir again, and I went to visit him in Mir. He's a wonderful, wonderful Talmud Chacham, individual, Baruch Hashem. Anyway, coming back here, so the court, IRS, took Manashevitz to court. Manashevitz got top quality lawyers, and they proved in court that the Manashevitz yeshiva, I quote the decision in court, an ordinary and necessary business expense. It could not otherwise have deducted these payments since the Jerusalem yeshiva did not qualify as a charitable organization to which contributions by corporations are deductible under the tax code in effect at that time. But what did Manashevitz show? That it needed to run a yeshiva to create the impression that they are 100% reliable. They had to show the court that it was beneficial in publicizing the company's products, payments for support of the yeshiva. The company candidly concluded, quote, have been made from combined religious, charitable, personal, and business motives, end quote. Powerful. The court decision reads, although there can be little doubt that the contributions to the seminary were prompted by a complex of motives, but there was reasonably evident business ends to be served, and the intention to serve them appears adequately from the record. Manischewitz won the case, and as Sana shows in his fascinating lecture, it was accepted by the court, legitimate.
What year was it?
1948. There must be court records. I mean, he did his research, and from the research, he was able to overcome the lack. You don't see this anywhere. Hapades is not going to carry material like this, but the court records, and you see Manischewitz, top quality business people, Rabbanim, Yerushalayim, everything sacred, everything holy, and the bottom line, the product was 100% Alpi Halacha and Manischewitz. There's no more name in the world more synonymous with Kashrut, with the kosher industry. And ultimately, they buy up everyone. It's amazing that the American government allows it, that it's not considered a monopoly. They bought up Goodman's, they bought up Horowitz Margaretten, they bought up Atlas Fish, they bought up Seasons. There's no end to the names of the companies that they bought up. And today, multi $100 million plus plant in Newark, New Jersey. They try to regentrify, you know, downtown Newark. They didn't totally succeed. This much I can tell you. But a lot of money was put into downtown Newark. And Manischewitz evidently got a good break on the land to build there, and on taxes, it creates, I don't have to tell you how many jobs it creates, and it's an amazing firm, so many years old. But remember what I showed you last week, that my Talmud, Mark Wiener, the rabbi doctor, lieutenant colonel, Mark, I have Talmud with many titles. Remember what I showed you last week? He photographed for me the packages of Horowitz Margaretten, Manischewitz being sold in Chicago. And I told you, Horowitz Margaretten, it's to create a false concept of competition. Because the American, the modern consumer has to have competition. You follow? So when you go into the store and you see Manischewitz, $3 a box. Horowitz Margaretten on sale, $2.80. So you're going to buy Horowitz Margaretten. You're buying, it's all Manischewitz. But what did we see in Chicago? That the matzah under their labels, made by Matzah Yehuda in Yerushalayim, I couldn't believe it. And there it is on the label. And I wonder what the reason is. Is it because they can't produce enough to meet the demand from the Newark plant? Or is it simply that the people are demanding a better tasting matzah, and Yerushalayim, our matzah here is much better tasting? What do you think, Seb?
Labor, it's cheaper.
Labor cheaper, I don't know. Would the importing could be? No. If they had bought the company, we would know about it. It didn't make headlines here. But very fascinating. I don't know the answer to why. It's an interesting question. I mean, I know why I would prefer Yehuda Matzah. Taste it. You'll see. There's a much better taste to the matzah here, whatever the reasons are. All right, now let me reward you for coming to class today. Aryeh, do you love Yeshiva University?
Sir.
Okay. There's a man, grandson of Rabbi Herbie Bamsa. Brings back a lot of memories for me. His grandfather. Oh. His grandfather was a Gesunta guy, too. Your grandfather, he was what?
The Rebbe in
BTA. Yeah, he was a Rebbe in BTA. He was the Rebbe of the young Israel of Ocean Parkway. a little building on Ocean Parkway with all the big buildings. Reb Meir Kahana's funeral began from that young Israel. I was there. I was at the funeral. My children were in here in Israel. I had just arrived in New York that Sunday, 2 hours before Meir was assassinated, lo aleinu.
Why did they bury him in America?
No, they buried him here, but the funeral began there on the way to the airport. Give the listen. Of course he was buried here, in Harman Uchot, if I'm not mistaken. And my children participated here. I was in America. So, you know, Brooklyn one time was a YU community. Today in Brooklyn, if you mention you go to YU, you have to hope it's an open-minded chassid. I'll put it that way. Washington Heights was a YU community. Then the Yekis came in, pardon me, the Germans, Torum Derech Eretz. Today already the yeshiva is there, but it's not a pleasant place. You walk on the streets, all you hear is Spanish. You go into the bank, I walk in, I don't look Puerto Rican. Speak Spanish to me, thank God, yo hablo español. I remember a little bit of my high school Spanish. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to go and boast you're from YU? Chicago? The biggest institution in Chicago is TELS, the TELS branch in Chicago. Hebrew, Skokie, for a long period, Skokie was going right wing. Now they've tried to pull back a little. Where are you going to go? There's no place you can go and feel free to boast you're a YU person. Dove, you know where you can go and boast and stand on the street corner, I am a YU person? Teaneck, New Jersey. Ah, my dear students, who created Teaneck? And here is an unbelievable story, the Manashevitz family. And here, let me fill you in, and I'll fill you in on what I picked up in Israel. A lady, a grand lady, Esther Manashevitz, 1922-2013. She wasn't born in America. She was born Esther Ostrovsky. Recognize the name? Her father was one of the Choshev Mizrahi Rabbanim. He later hebraized his name Hameiri. You'll always see the name hyphenated. Ostrovsky Hameiri. Or Hameiri Ostrovsky. Parents committed total Zionist. Came in Aliyah's kids. Father was from Pinsk. Mother from a small village near Pinsk. Moved to Israel as children. Grew up in Israel. Esther was one of their children. Studied at the Mizrahi Seminary for Women, Talmidam with Heket of Nechama Leibovitz. Talmidam with Heket. As a matter of fact, someplace online, Bernard Revel Graduate School, a year or two before she died, she was ill already, they interviewed her about Nechama Leibovitz. I remember watching the interview online, fascinating, because I knew Nechama Leibovitz very, very, very well. I would say intimately, we were very close. We taught together, we interacted together, we joked together, we fought together. There were certain issues we debated. I write about it in Washington, ongoing. And she was Talmidah, she was a Talmidah. And her family, this was Yerushalayim, I daven in shul with old-time Yerushalmiim. They couldn't believe they cut the name. You know what happened with Esther Strachovsky? I told them, they were happy to hear. She was a gem. She was one of a kind. She was brilliant. She was good-looking. How do you say it in Yiddish? Alamailas. Kol hama'alot. All the good attributes. And then what happened, she made a little money, and she decided to visit America, see what's doing, just to visit, not to stay. And while she was in America, she gets a telegram that her first cousin is coming to America on business. He came a number of times, and he sent her a telegram, come meet me at the pier where the boat is docking. She was still in America another week or two, and she went to meet her first cousin at the boat, who was coming. Esther Manischewitz. Can I give you a year? One second. It's about 1950, I would say. Okay? This is after the War of Independence. Esther fought with the Haganah. She taught during the war. There were no men teachers. This was to catch her breath. 49-50 it probably is. And some other friend of her first cousin came to the boat.
What was the cousin's name?
That they don't give all they say, Jacob. That Jacob was a first cousin. Let me see if there's a name here. No, I don't see a name. Just gives the name Jacob. And he came to America several times a year. He sent me a telegram, please come to the pier. Jacob was not only my first cousin, but he was also related to Mrs. Manischewitz, to Sarah Manischewitz. Remember I told you that, or if not Sarah, one of the Manischewitz's wives. Remember I told you the two eldest sons married women with Jerusalem ties. So this may be, I don't think it was Sarah, I think it was the other daughter-in-law of Manischewitz. She was related. So her son, Bill Manischewitz, came to the pier as well. And when he came to the pier, he sees this young lady, and they say to him, do you know who she is? And he says, no, Bill Manischewitz replied, but I'd sure like to know who she is. And they say, this is Estika Ostrovsky. Estika is a diminutive form Yiddish. Estika Ostrovsky. They soon married, and she remained in America against her will, but the family, he was in the business, a well-known name, Bill Manischewitz, and they lived in Manhattan. They were to have three daughters. After their eldest daughter was born in 53, the mother-in-law said to the young couple, it's not a place to live, to raise children. You all recognize it's the old question. There's no backyard. The kids can't run around. There are too many cars. Why don't you move to a suburb? Bill's mother suggested that we move out of the city. A place in New Jersey with the odd name of Teaneck had a large conservative synagogue with an Orthodox rabbi. That's true, that there was a large conservative temple. The rabbi, do you remember the name of the...
Was that Feldman?
No, it's before Feldman.
Washa.
Judah Washa. Thank you. Judah Washa. We worked together on the name. Judah Washa. He was a Talmud of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, very highly thought of in the yeshiva, and he was in this conservative or conservadox synagogue. Today it's Orthodox. Today it has a mechitza, but you know, times have changed. And reportedly, a breakaway Orthodox minyan had been started. Well, the family was happy. They could move. There's a conservative temple, and there's a breakaway with an Orthodox minyan. When they moved there, their family found there was no such minyan. After 8 years of occasionally going to New York for Shabbos and davening at home with family and neighbors, the Manischewitzes considered another move. Paterson, New Jersey. Paterson, New Jersey was home, first of all, to Orthodox shuls, and then had a day school, Yapner Academy. I remember the day school. Paterson. And while they're considering the move, They're attending adult education classes at Yeshiva University Community Service Division. You remember all this? CSD, Community Service. This was what today is, what's it called? The Center for Jewish Future, CJF. CSD, they were running classes in Englewood, where you had Ahavat Torah was beginning, and at the Yavner Academy. And going to these classes were five families living in Teaneck. The Grunmans, the Landaus, the Bravermans, the Kapitnikovs, and the Manashevises. And they started saying, we're not happy in the temple. We want an Orthodox synagogue. They turned to YU. Well, you turn to CSD. Who gets involved? Vic Geller. Remember the name? Vic Geller arrives, and he guides them. First, you need a place to daven. Lillian Kapitnikov volunteered her basement. The shul became known as Congregation Lil's Basement. Then they needed a Sefer Torah. Bill Manashevitz. I'm supplying the Torah. A minyan appeared, a rabbi was hired, and they gave the shul a name. How did they give the shul a name? Estika came from Yerushalayim. What was the most famous, prestigious, state-of-the-art shul in Yerushalayim? Yeshurin. The shul became named B'nai Yeshurin. And what you don't realize, that Yeshurin is the greatest mistake the conservative movement made. Who built Yeshurin? Zionism, post-World War I, early 30s. What today would be millions of dollars raised by the United Synagogue of the conservative movement. They built Yeshurin and gave it as a gift to the Jewish people in Jerusalem. Who took charge of it? A self-perpetuating board of trustees. You follow? It's not an election. The first board of trustees was selected by acclamation. And they're now responsible. Well, who did you select? Who would be on the board of trustees? These were all shul Jews, Jerusalem Jews, professors, medical doctors, religious Jews. I need not tell you. It's self-perpetuating, and you see what Yeshurin became. Could you imagine had Yeshurin been retained by the United Synagogue instead of the little corner, the Fuchsburg Synagogue, Yeshurin would be the home of conservative Judaism. And I can tell you more. You want to know more? That conservative synagogue on the corner, built by well-meaning, assimilated American Jews, their grandchildren are totally from Balei Tshuva, 100% observant, and they would not daven in the shul their grandparents built in the heart of Jerusalem. It's an amazing world.
I know.
And that's why they got rid of them. That's why they got rid of them. A terrible Orthodox. Oh, boy.
Even though they were JTS
graduates? I know, they were JTS graduates from a different era. Today already it's a different shul, but it never took off. It remains, you know, for tourists. Doesn't have a heart of people who integrate and want to remain conservative. But this is Esther. She gave B'nai Yeshurin its name. Bill gave it the first Sefer Torah. And as they say, the rest is history. They hired a rabbi, a long list of rabbanim. There was labeled doulas. He was the rub there. Didn't last long. Macy Gordon put it on the map.
He was right after Doolittle's?
As I recall, he was right after Doolittle's. I'm pretty certain I'm right. What do you say, Seb? As I recall.
Yeah, Doolittle's didn't last.
Doolittle's didn't last very long. Personality-wise, he didn't lend himself. It's like Chief Rabbi Gorin. His personality was fit to give commands, to be a general. But as a rabbi, to get along with people on a personal level, he was not the best. Label was there, Doolittle's was there. Label Doolittle's was there, Macy was there. I think even Reb Heschel Schachter was there shortly. There was something also in Teaneck. And Steve Przanski has been there from time immemorial now. You have no idea. He won a battle. Remember the story with Foxman, Abe Foxman. Abe Foxman davened there, and Abe Foxman is a survivor, and many survivors are leftists. It's very interesting. Could be psychologically, you can explain it. They saw so much blood, so much killing. They think if we can be leftist and talk peace, we can achieve a lot more. And Abe Foxman took the rabbi on. Remember that? What went on? And generally speaking, when a balabas is famous as Abe Foxman takes on a Tyro rabbi who just arrived from Queens, you would put your money in Abe Foxman. And Rabbi Przanski won a knockout victory. Abe Foxman left the shul, and the New York Times had to write it up, al apam v'chamatam, my student, my dear Rabbi Steve Przanski won. Baruch Hashem. What Teaneck became, Esther always suffered that she wasn't in Israel. You see, there are people who go in Yeridah and are happy to be away from Israel, from the tension, from the pressure. If you just heard the news at 9 o'clock, I just turned on the news before I came into class, you can, if you take it too seriously, you can be sick with Russia, with Syria, with what they want to do. The threats against Israel. Hear the news. No, they run to America. Who listens to news there every hour? I never met people who listen or take the news that seriously. America's big, powerful. What can go wrong? All right, there's 9/11. Occasionally something happens. Today they're shooting people all over the place. I mean, in Florida, two policemen are in a waffle bar and someone comes in naked and blows them away. I mean, it's beyond words, beyond words. And they can't find the guy. New people can walk away. And evidently that's normal. You walk stark nude and no one says boo. Unbelievable. And there was more trouble yesterday. But those are exceptions. There are people who leave the country and all their life they suffer a guilt conscience why they left the state of Israel. And Esther Kerr, she established the local Mizrahi group, the Sinai chapter, today known as Amit Women. She was the first president. She was the guiding spirit. The lady never gave up her key connection to Israel. And it's unbelievable. Halacha l'maisa, when you talk about Teaneck, you have to speak about the Manashevitz family. B'nai Yeshurun, the powerhouse, the first big shul, the first success story, you have to speak about B'nai Yeshurun. Okay. Let's go a step further. Manashevitz is on the map. The matzah was always never questioned. A student just emailed me, what about the wine? And it's true, when we were growing up, they always said Manashevitz wine is not on the level of the other wines, the Gnelis Lange, Shapiro, Kedem. Those were the wines that I remember as a kid. What was wrong with Manashevitz wine, I don't know. I never researched it. It could be there was nothing wrong, but it didn't have the level of the family and the hashkacha. It wasn't the matzah. Nowadays, of course, Manashevitz wine is under the OU, and no one says boo because the OU, when they give hashgacha, you have the Rolls Royce of kashrut, I'll put it that way. Welch grape juice, a few years ago, Welch went with Manischewitz. Do they still give Welch? Well, Pesach, you in America. Was Welch, you were here. Was Welch grape juice still available with Manischewitz? They merged. It's all under one name, one label. Wow, unbelievable. But
is there matzah have an OU too?
Matzah has an OU, of course. Manischewitz, of course it has an OU. Am I right or wrong? I believe all their products have an OU. I know their gefilte fish has an OU. All their products have an OU. That's what I imagine. But let me go one step further now. With all that we've spoken about and all the achievement on the American scene, nothing compares to what happened with the OU. How it happened, it's almost like Kaliachayad. It wasn't something planned. It wasn't something envisioned. Where do we find the story? And here I want to call your attention to an individual. Unfortunately, time moves on and no one knows the name. I mentioned the name Saul Bernstein. Does it mean anything to anybody? I had the privilege of knowing him quite well. Saul Bernstein, I believe he was the executive director of the OU. I believe that was the title. Excuse me? And he was the editor of Jewish Life, was the magazine they put out. Later in life, he wrote a number of books. One, The Renaissance of the Torah Jew by Saul Bernstein. That came out in 1985, published by Kitab. I just want to see there. I believe he wrote another book. He wrote a volume on the history of the OU per se. These were the two volumes. I think the other volume on the history of the OU, yeah, here it is. The Orthodox Union Story, a Century Portrayal, 1997. These two volumes, very, very fascinating. How did the OU begin? All right. In kashrus across the United States, there was chaos. There was not only chaos, there was a terrible reputation. In every community, there was endless machloikas. We referred to the book, Fraud, Corruption, and Holiness. We'll come back to that book again. Much more has been written. Rabbi Zev Goldberg is sitting here, and he can tell you his grandfather was caught up in tremendous machloket in Boston. That's how the Rav gets to Boston. His grandfather dies of a heart attack, it was, in the middle of all the machloikas. A young man, he was in his 50s. Mm-hmm. And the Rav comes to Boston, and he's caught up in terrible machloikas, so much so that he's ready to leave Boston for Chicago. More than that, and this has to be said, you can't whitewash it. When Reb Moshe died, and it's very revealing, when Reb Moshe died, the students were split against the Rav being appointed to succeed his father. Many of the students, and I know some of the names who led the battle, they viewed the Rav as Agudas HaRabbanim, as Machlokes, as phony kashrut, chaos. This was the reputation of the Rabbanit Agudas HaRabbanim. And so we're talking the Rav, yeah. Rav Lazer Silver, they used to tell a joke. I heard this, I've heard it from the Rav Kaliachayad. You know, meat has to be washed off after slaughter, what is it, every 72 hours, right? You have to wash it off to keep it fresh. This is the whole silo with frozen meat. With frozen meat, they shech the meat. Today, I think they kasha there in Rome. Wherever they slaughter, Israel slaughters, they send out crews, tremendous crews. It's a tremendous business because we don't have cattle here. We have very few cattle. In the Golan Heights, you'll talk to see cowboys. You know what the word in Hebrew is? Boker, bokrim. That's the word for cowboys. So there you'll taka see, but very few. So they send out, they slaughter, then they ship the meat over, frozen obviously. No, the meat is not washed off. Just the whole shiloh with frozen meat. This is the difference between kosher and glatt kosher. All right, I'm not here to asa, not at all. Anyone who knows what frozen meat is, there's nothing better than frozen meat. It's a lot fresher than the meat being washed off, and it keeps fresh, and you can kosher it when you defrost it. Rav Herzog was mekhil. The Rav was mekhil. The Sri Deye, there were many mekhilim. But okay, glatt means it's kashered right away. They don't wait 72 hours. So the joke so used to...
They freeze it before kashering or after?
No, before. If they freeze it after kashering, who not? It's no shiner. After kashering, you can do whatever you want with the meat.
It's
Well, no, sirchus is also part of it, of course. But here, the main difference is not so much the sirchus as the freezing and not freezing. Because first, it has to be glatt. But if it's not glatt, and then they ship it without, and they don't kosher it, so even if it is glatt, I should say, many people don't want to use it. But there was the endless machloikis. I remember Fabian Schoenfeld, the early 70s, his daughter went to Michola Machal. So she asked her father, asked the Rav. The Rav looked at him like he stepped off, you know, said, what, you're asking an Arisha Shaila? If they freeze it, nothing keeps the meat fresher than that. But the joke, what I want to tell you is, the joke that made the rounds was that the slaughter of the cattle is in Wisconsin. The Rav HaMachshir is in Cincinnati. And the meat is washed off in Pittsburgh. And what they're referring to is that the Wisconsin was taka the slaughter, the Midwest, Omaha, Nebraska was another place, a big slaughterhouse. And they would ship the meat to New York. No, in those days, there's no plane. It takes a nice few days. The meat has to be washed. So Pittsburgh is where they would stop, and that's where they would hose down the meat. So the vot was, The mashgiach is in Cincinnati, Reblaza Silva. The meat is slaughtered out in the Midwest, and they're washing it off in Pittsburgh. But more than that, what do you do when you're shipping the meat, and the meat winds up traveling on Shabbos, traveling on Yontif? No, who washes off the meat? How do you wash off the meat? Ah, this takes us back to yesterday's shiur. Can you trust Goyim to wash off the meat? And I'm afraid to tell you this. The Rav said, Kaliachayad, he says, sometimes I think the Gentiles are more reliable than the Jews. You follow? If you take the Goyim and you tell them what you have to do, and this is a religious matter, then they are going to respond. Now, with all this chaos and all that went on, by the 1920s, you have Torah people, observant people, who think in modern terms and want kashrut and want something reliable. And it all begins with the women. Any good innovation, you got to credit the women. By the 1920s, the OU has a women's branch. Women's branch of the OU. It's like ladies' auxiliaries. Later it got a more sophisticated name, the sisterhood. But this was the women's branch of the OU. And they started pressuring the union's branch. 1923 starts pressuring the OU, give us good kosher products. By the 1920s, you have conglomerations and manufacture, and you can go into a store already, and there are hundreds of different canned products. Why can't we have decent supervision? The OU meets, and they realize they're not rabbis, but what comes out of the meetings, two tremendous decisions. One, the rabbis who are part of the OU, and I'll mention this in passing in a second, they will be in charge of the supervision. The Balabatim, the OU, will be in charge of the money. Second decision, which, believe it or not, is right in the headlines in the state of Israel at this very moment. No rabbi is paid by the plant, the people, the product he supervises. Everyone is paid by the OU, by the Balabatam. It has nothing to do with where, who, what you are supervising. Do you recognize this? What's going on in Israel today? What's one of the greatest, Tzohar, that opened its own supervision? What's one of their great complaints against the chief rabbinate? That the mashkichim are being paid by the people they supervise. How can you have kashrut? You understand? When you get involved, when a balabas faces chveis, you want to throw out 50 pounds of meat that you found the problem with, he's looking at 50 pounds of loss. He's paying. He's going to look at you and threaten you. This was a great innovation of the OU. Now, the rabbis, you're probably wondering, though, what rabbis are part of the OU, right or wrong? Yeah, rabbis, but there's no rabbinical organization. The 1920s, you have two new rabbinic groups being organized. One is Yeshiva University Rabbinic Alumni, which then was called Yeshiva Rabbinic Alumni. It was not yet a university. The other one was, with the OU, there was a whole rabbinic division. Why did this happen? Because the Agudat Rabbanim made a decision, we'll talk about this in detail, but not yet. This is something that haunts the Agudas HaRabbanim in the 1920s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. The Agudas Rabbanim made a decision, no American-trained rabbi can be a member of the Agudas HaRabbanim. The graduates of Yeshiva Shabbat are halfwits. What's Kenan say? What do they know? We learned, we got smicha in Europe, we've had a no shas and paiskim. Here, you get smicha from YU, Aryeh is getting smicha. He learned a little bit in Yoredeya, and all right, a few hundred daf gemara. Well, the Yudapayesh Rabbanim, big deal. I learned a few hundred daf gemara at my bar mitzvah already. I knew a few hundred daf. You follow? This is a very serious issue. And wow, they made a decision. You don't know what went on in the 20s, the 30s. Had they accepted the American-trained rabbis, the whole history of Torah in the United States would have been a different history, a different story. It's an amazing issue when you think of it. If is probably the most important word in the dictionary. If. Would have been a whole different story. But they made that decision. Ultimately, because they made that decision, the OU rabbis and the yeshiva graduates, and most rabbanim in America were yeshiva shevus chachanim graduates, ultimately merge mid-30s, and what do they form? RCA, Rabbinical Council of America. The biggest rabbinic body in the world today. Right or wrong, biggest rabbinic body in the world today. Agudas Rabbanim, there's nothing left. We'll talk about it. We'll see what happens. Today, they have property left. The last time they were in the news was the usual story, a fight over who the property can belong to so they can sell it and pocket the nice millions of dollars they'll get for it. On the east side today, property is very valuable. Chinatown expanded. The Chinese have money. They're regentrifying the area. It's the heart of the world. You're within walking distance to Wall Street. You follow what we're talking about? All right. That's when they were in the news over the building on East Broadway, I think it is.
So who remains of the Agudas Rabbanim?
Today, very little. Almost nothing.
Their children, grandchildren?
Many of them are living here in Israel. What do you want?
Somebody owns that land.
That's what the machlokes is over. I don't want to mention names, but they were in court and fighting. So a lot of money involved. But it's not a vibrant organization that has power and influence today. Had they made the decision, we accept the mismachim of the yeshiva, the whole history would have been different. But all right, they didn't make that decision. And ultimately, when we speak about the rabbis and the balabatim, ultimately, you're talking about RCA and OU. When you worked for the OU, Dov, who were your rabbinic advisors? Who did you turn to? And you had the representative of RCA. At your time, it was Manny Holzer, who guided the interaction between the OU and the RCA. In other words, the Balabatim never made decisions on Kashrut. Their responsibility was the money. What to charge, how to charge, how to pay, who to employ, what to do with the profits of the money. The Rabbanim were the ones who made the decision in Kashrut, and ultimately you wind up having two great Rabbanim, Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Shachter, who make your decisions. Today you have Rabbi Shachter and Rabbi Weiss. You can't do better than that, right or wrong? And not to take money. And it's epic making. I mean, this happened. It happened because the women had foresight and wanted a product. And let me say something else. Among the first to supervise, I think they were actually the second. The first I'll give you the exact name. It's the Louisville cookie company. Let's see if I have an exact name for them. They were the first. 1 second. There was a company in Louisville, Kentucky that made soup crackers. Saltines, I think they were called. No, not Nabisco. Nabisco comes much, much later. I believe they were the first company that was supervised by the OU. The second company was Heinz. The Heinz supervision was absolutely major. Now, Heinz, the original company, didn't mind if you put on it Kashrut, Union of Orthodox Congregations. Heinz had a problem. And this problem, believe it or not,
Sunshine.
May go on in Sunshine. Sunshine was the name. But then I believe they were in Louisville, Kentucky.
And they were bought out by the
Fisco. Okay, that's the company. Sunshine Crackers. Thank you. They were the first. The second was Heinz. Heinz had a problem. It's all here. And it's a problem that goes on in tooth today to a certain degree. They're Gentiles who are anti-Semitic. They don't want to have a product in their house that reads kosher. They don't want to have a product in their house that reads rabbis. So how do you give supervision? How do you market? How do you label it? What the OU came up with Heinz, was a very simple concept, an OU. Innocent letters that have no meaning to the average person. When the Ku Klux Klan sees a product with the OU, it doesn't rile them up the way a rabbi's name or a symbol of that would say kosher or Union of Orthodox Congregations would upset them. And that's how the OU begins. It is the most successful label of kashrut in the world. Everyone else emulates them. We'll talk about it next week. But the OU, Schut Rishonim, a genius idea. A simple idea. It wasn't, the original OU didn't exactly look the way it looks today. It was a little bit different, but it was the same concept. An OU. They perfected it as time moved on. New? Wow, what an achievement. Beginning, Heinz, that already was major. Tell me, Bernstein writes this. How do I know he's right? How can I prove it? How did I feel it on my back? Bibisari echezeno. No, just go back to the 70s. Gentlemen, the biggest manufacturer of candy in the world. Give me the name, Hershey. Hershey, Pennsylvania, a city unto itself. In the 70s, the OU achieved an unbelievable breakthrough. Hershey's was willing to go kosher. Were you working at the OU then, Dove?
No.
You don't? 80s. So you're after this. Nope. Can anyone tell me what happened? Hershey's put on a condition. No symbol of kashrut at all.
Really? It was kosher, but didn't hear the audience.
You hear it? Two rabbanim are testifying, Yitzchak. Hershey's said, too many anti-Semites, Ku Klux Klan people know what the OU means, that symbol. We want no symbol at all. The OU faced a tremendous quagmire now. It's an insult to Torah, an insult to the Jewish people, an insult to Kashrut. What do you do? And I want to tell you, there was an honest debate. Some people said, tell the Hershey's to go to hell. Plain and simple. But other people said, I quote Mary Holzer, that Jewish kids should have Hershey's. We'll swallow our pride. And Hershey's became kosher without a symbol. And I remember in BMT, Hershey's reaching, kids coming back from, it's not like today, you can go to Machne Yehuda and buy many Hershey products. They job them out here. So, and the question came up, and Manny said to me, tell them they can eat it, there's no problem, even without the symbol of kashrut. Later, it took off so that the OU was, their hand was stronger than Hershey's. Hershey's recognized there's no end to the markets that the OU can open for us. They're anti-Semites, but the amount of Ku Klux Klan people who won't buy Hershey's because it has an OU is buckle the shishim against the new markets that open to us. And you should know, even though Hershey's isn't Chalav Yisrael, they even Hasidic kids who sneak around the corner. You have no idea what goes on. I'll tell you a little story. Roy Albert, Rabbi Albert, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. Let me recall Roy Albert. We'll end off with this story. Bididenu Haviyuvda. Roy, the end of his rabbinate in Queens, the neighborhood was going under. He made a panasa. He was in Sunnyside, Queens. Neighborhood was going under. Today it's still again being regentrified and it becomes a better neighborhood because there are a short subway ride into Manhattan. So Manhattan is so expensive, Queens, Sunnyside, Queens is a lot cheaper. Long Island City, this is that area. So Roy was making a panasa out of funerals. The funeral chapels knew if they need a rabbi, Roy's available. Now, he'd do a funeral, come back from the funeral, and someplace in Brooklyn on the way back from the cemetery was an outlet store for Entenmann's. So Roy would drop into the store, you know, get. He would notice whenever he would drop into the store, there are Hasidic Yidden buying Entenmann's. And they would be a little bit embarrassed, Holovakum. And they would say to Roy, das ist für die Kinder. It's for the children. Do you follow? It's the same thing with my wife. She says, we can't eat that much sugar. We're older. We're this. We're that. And if I buy a good product, I say it's for the children. What a bluff. But Father Kinder, Father Kinder. Excuse me?
The children in us.
The children in us. But what a story, how the OU begins. Who could ever imagine this would change the entire world? Do you realize you can travel? I was at the end of the world in Cairns when I was in Australia, and they asked, what is my fee? I said, I have no fees. Arrange touring. I made a deal with them. What am I going to take your money to give lectures? What am I going to do? Baruch Hashem, I make a living. But I want a tour. Set me up. So they gave me a choice of New Zealand or the Great Barrier Reef, if you know what I'm talking about. So I said, no, the Great Barrier Reef. I want to see the end of the world. So here we are, mamish, the end of the world. You can fall off. It's the end of Australia. But it's a tremendous naval base because it's opposite Japan from World War II. What an area. And here I am at the end of the world. And across the street from the hotel is a supermarket. You go in, it's unbelievable. Not that they care for kosher. But they're bringing in the products from Sydney, from Melbourne. It has hashgacha. They're bringing in Häagen-Dazs from France. It has hashgacha. They're bringing in bagels. Ribbono shel Olam, jellies. It's all over the world. More than that, you go into a supermarket in South Africa, 80% of the products, 90% have hashgacha. So I asked them, who needs hashgacha? All right, I understand the supermarkets and it's all Jewish owned, and in the Jewish areas, they have kosher meat area, and they have, the bakeries are all kosher, and they have milky parv, it's unbelievable, with a mashgiach or mashgicha. One of the ladies there who came to all my lectures, she's the mashgicha in Cape Town in the big super. But I can understand you have kosher sections. But every last product made in South Africa has a hashgacha on it. I couldn't understand it. And they told me the secret, that in order to export from South Africa, you have to have rabbinic supervision. Why? Because the world considers South Africa a primitive country. A primitive country means it isn't clean. If it has hashgacha, the plant has to be clean. It has to meet standards of kashrut, which include cleanliness, obviously. So anyone exporting is getting hashgacha. And you can see it in Machne Yehuda, all types of candy from South Africa with the bagats from their bacon on it. Unbelievable. And this all began, all made possible by OU with sunshine crackers, exactly. Four together, you divide it up. I remember them like yesterday. There were salty ones and non-salty.
Still exist?
It's under Nabisco, and it exists in many forms today. They imitate it.
Saltine,
unbelievable. All right. Gentlemen, what have we accomplished?
So you have an OU now?
Then they saw they can gain so much more business with it. No, that's what I said, that the Ku Klux Klan is Batel B'Shishim.
So what year did they start with the OU?
The OU, I can only venture a guess that the OU went on by the late 70s. I can venture a guess. Maybe the OU would know. You can, the thing is, the time moves on. Rabbi, when I mention the name Rabbi Holzer, no one realizes who I'm talking about. Manny Holzer. Manny Holzer had one advantage. He didn't have to hold down a job. He had married into the Dyckman family. His father-in-law had property, and he helped the father-in-law. And people used to be, cynics used to say, well, if you married into that family, you also would have time to work for the OU, to work for Klal Yisrael. I said, you're a bunch of phonies. If you married into that family, you'd be busy trying to make more money, I said. But Manny, give him credit. He's available for the Rav at any moment. He's available for the OU. He's available for RCA. The man was totally dedicated to work for the Jewish people. Did you know Manny from the OU? You know what I'm talking about. And God has wonderful children. wonderful grandchildren. Ganayim Hara, the Ribbono Shel Olam rewarded him. Okay, so to reiterate, an interesting shiur today, at least less serious than what we had to deal with yesterday. Mamzeret, remember you said to me I gave this shiur in Florida. I'm nowhere near finished. How many weeks have I been in it? But yesterday we did a whole world. It's the whole concept of nemanut of a secular court. And next week we'll deal with impotency, which again is a fascinating topic. And we dealt with the Rav and Rabbi Rachman, and it was a world. Today, Manashevitz, unbelievable. The Manashevitz Yeshiva. Interesting if the old timers know what happened to it. I have to ask the man in my shoe, Chaim Schlesberg, is from the old city, rooted Israeli, my age exactly.
That's 1948, that's years ago.
Yeah, but he's my age. Maybe he has some memory. And he knew of Estika Hamayiri. He got all excited when I told him that she remained frum and she built a whole community. You know, and he said when the word went out she's marrying a Manashevitz and remaining in America, he said people were so upset here because she was like Gdilata Aretz L'Tiferet. She was something of a flower that blossomed in Jerusalem L'Tiferet, and she's winding up in America. People were upset. Oh, he was all excited. I'm curious whether grandchildren, great-grandchildren have come back. And then when we finished with Manashevitz, we went into the OU. I have to go further with the OU and show you how it affects others. We have to deal with the OK, how that began, and the Machlekin and what they saw. And we have to deal with some of the problems with the plumber, give you a taste of some of the Machlekis that went on. But it's a fascinating development. What a difference in the 1920s, the OU, to RJJ in 1887, when he tried to bring order to Kashrut, fell flat in his face. Now, a few freebies. These are historic documents that I got off the Shurin, the Rabbi Shurin Soloveitchik file. This is from 1955. RCA used to produce a newspaper. Today it's all online. And this is the Baron Cutler. I think it's the only time he addressed the Rabbinical Council of America. This is a release on the Rav. It's the mid-1950s, Irwin Spiegel. You remember that name? He was the New York Times correspondent on Jewish affairs. And it's Rebbe speaking about we have the right to explore outer space.
They asked him things like that?
Yeah. It's a talk he gave at RCA. This is 1959, a news release. It's amazing. This comes out of the computer. I am the biggest fan of the computer. I wish I knew how to use it to its depth. A news release on who the Rav is from YUPR. If anyone is a historian, this is the Jefferson letter that was presented to YU in 1986. It's, I think, the most valuable document that YU owns. It's the letter he wrote to Mordechai Mandel Noah, praising the Jewish people. And YU has the original letter. I think the Jesselsons presented it. This is unbelievably fascinating. Medgar Evers College in Crown Heights. New, do you know what's going on? They're opening up their doors to the Hasidim there, giving credit for yeshiva training and studies. They will be a big rival for Turo in Brooklyn, in certainly the Chabad world. This is in Crown Heights. It has implications that go way beyond the area. These are two articles, the same, on Liberty University from the New York Times. Halavai, why you would learn from these articles. This is Baptist, that element, Jerry Falwell, billion-dollar organizations, colleges. It's amazing how they work and what they do. It's the New York Times. Some is pro, some is not. This is Judah Harris. He's a photographer who's done some exhibitions. It's all about his photography that appeared in the New York Times and what he's working on now. This is in Yonadiyoma, Gangsters for Zion. My brother sent me Rockaway. He wrote the book that's to the Jewish Mafia. This is an article about the Jewish Mafia and how they helped Israel.
Right.
Fascinating.
I set that on.
These are two copies. I highly recommend reading it. It's about a couple that married right before the state was organized. 70 years of marriage. He is 93 today, she is 90. They live in Yerushalayim, they're in a senior citizens facility. And it's worth reading this article. Unbelievable what they went through. Their values in life, the children they raised, Ashrem Shezachinu L'dor Kazeh. It's a funny name. It's Carniel. The original name was different. They hebraized it. So Carniel would be Karen El. That's the way I would read it. Chava and Yeshayahu Carniel. They're Yekes who came in Aliyah, and they tell what they went through as Yekes. The curses. I told Malka, I used to hear these curses 50 years ago when we first came. The same, I don't want to repeat the curse, it's not nice, the malediction. But they left it off. Every Aliyah goes through hell. That's part of the process here. And I advise you to go to Fort Lee, New Jersey, the Shabbos that a guy named Rakefet spoke there, and listen to Rakefet's talk on Dor HaMidbar. Okay? That's what Aliyah is about. And I just used it because Shabbos morning I'm walking home from shul, minding my business, rushing to wake up Malka. She has to go to her shul. No Jew davens in the same shul. We all have different shuls. So I daven 6:30, 49 years. And I'm not going to start davening Shabbos. 6:30, finish at 8. Can learn 3 daf gemara until mincha time. Wow. And my wife goes to Yakar, where they love to daven. They begin at 8:15 and they finish at 12 o'clock. I never heard anything like it. The Hallel takes an hour with Chazanim and singing. And I very fachslidim bin nachalitvak. So as I'm rushing home, a very famous Rebbetzin sees me, Rebbetzin Druk. And she calls me over. And she says, I live across the street from you. I know you 50 years. I know the children you raised, etc., etc. I didn't know you wrote 2 volumes on Rav Soloveitchik, and everyone tells me that, don't want to repeat her words, but, and she's teaching Rav Soloveitchik. She said, how can I get them in Hebrew? And I told her they're in English. I said, my grandchildren too are angry at me that they're not in Hebrew. And she said, why don't you try? And she's giving me hell. And I tell her, I am the Dor HaMidbar. Look up the Ibn Ezra. I think she knew it on Pashat Peshalach. She got her answer. Gentlemen.
Would the publisher do the translation?
Yeah. Who has time? I have to keep working
on it. Not you, the publisher.
And you think he does a translation, I have to sit over him. And some stuff is originally in Hebrew. Some stuff is in Yiddish. I translate into some stuff is in English, some stuff I edited, some stuff tapes. What a work that is. But it's in English. What can I do? It's my native language. I write Hebrew like a high school kid. English I write a little bit better. Here is Alon Anava. Is there life after death? I don't know. They try to make people from, they give the sound. It doesn't speak to me, but you're welcome. I'd like to hear other opinions. Finally, I just want to show you, this is a publisher who became from through Shvut Ami. These are all Russian books. Everything available in Russian. It's a bigger catalog than Art Scroll. Everything under the sun. unbelievable. Everything.
Apparently he has a Berkowitz.
I don't know, Czech. It's hard to comprehend what has happened. And the Kavala told that should keep on moving forward.
How would you tell? It's all in Russian.
No, it gives you Hebrew. Okay. Until we meet again in health and happiness, thank you very, very much for coming and honoring me. Das Vedanya.